Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Chinese government reacted yesterday to the arrest in Canada at U.S. request of Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou on charges of violating U.S. sanctions on Iran. The government-aligned newspaper Global Times called the arrest despicable, and the U.S. Commerce Department began warning American businessmen about travel to China. Meng will be arraigned in Vancouver, but any extradition could take years. Next, the Ecuadorian president, Lenin Moreno, has ramped up pressure on WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange to leave his country's embassy in London. Moreno said yesterday that the UK government has agreed to not extradite Assange to any country where he might face the death penalty. But that's a red herring. Assange already has been indicted in the United States, probably for national security crimes, which do not call for the death penalty. Then, today is the 77th anniversary of the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. President Franklin D. Roosevelt called December 7th a date which will live in infamy. It has lived in infamy. But was the bombing of Pearl Harbor an intelligence failure or a pretext for the U.S. to enter the war? And then all major tourist sites in Paris will be closed this weekend as authorities expect what they are calling major violence from anti-government demonstrations. The so-called yellow vest protests have swelled this week even after the government postponed the tax increase that set them off. 89,000 police will be deployed around the country along with armored personnel carriers. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to U.S.-China relations. The Chinese government reacted yesterday to the arrest in Canada at U.S. request of Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou on charges of violating U.S. sanctions on Iran. The government-aligned newspaper Global Times called the arrest despicable, and the U.S. Commerce Department began warning American businessmen about travel to China. Meng was arraigned in Vancouver today, but any extradition could take years. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure to be here.
Jack, we talked about this yesterday and some more details have come out today. Can you give us an update?
Yes. Well, I think the most interesting detail is that Trump indicated publicly that he did not know of the arrest as he went into the G20 meeting with President Xi. Interesting. And it came out briefly afterwards that John Bolton, who is a notorious anti-China hawk, and he's part of the anti-China faction within the trade negotiations team of the U.S., the other guys, Lighthizer and Navarro, he admitted he did know. So Bolton knew of the arrest before going into the dinner with Xi, but Trump didn't. What's going on here?
That is something. I mean, and you believe it. In other words, it's not hard cop, soft cop. You actually right. think that John Bolton, national security advisor to Trump, kept Trump in the dark while Trump was meeting with Xi Jinping, and after which he emerged from the meeting saying, this is great. It's going to be a wonderful new era. We have a great deal. Xi Jinping, though, undoubtedly must have known by then because it was the same day, no?
Well, it certainly wasn't brought up in the meeting. I think maybe they were trying to check it out. I don't know what Xi actually knew. But what it represents, in my view, is that the hardline faction does not want a trade deal with China unless there's significant agreement on China slowing its technology, next-generation technology initiatives. You know, if you look at Lighthizer's report that set this thing all off in August 2017, it was an attack on China's 2025 program, which was to be leaders by 2030 in cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and 5G wireless. Now, Huawei is a global leader in 5G wireless, which is necessary for cybersecurity next generation technologies. So that's why they're focusing on Huawei. And I think that the hardline faction is going to prevent any kind of a deal with China until they get some satisfactory terms and conditions on that. Unlike the Mnuchin banker faction, which simply wants some more access, which China has agreed to. China is playing the Mnuchin and the U.S. agribusiness faction against the hardline technology faction. But right now, the hardline technology faction in the U.S. trade is in the driver's seat, and Trump actually gave the 90-day lead to Lighthizer to negotiate.
Brian, I have to say, I was shocked at the Chinese reaction to this so far. I thought it was very measured, and frankly, it was even the opposite of what I would have expected.
Yeah. Well, I was just reading Global Times, which is not the official organ of the Chinese Communist Party, and the People's Daily, which is state-owned. Both of them today, I'm not talking about yesterday, where they called the arrest despicable. Today, the editorial is very conciliatory towards the United States. In the last two paragraphs, it says, some observers believe that strategic competition has already developed between Beijing and Washington, and easing this tension is unlikely. But this is a passive viewpoint. China wants to rise peacefully and help build a community with a shared future for mankind. To realize that goal, it must develop constructive Sino-US and Sino-Western relations. Temporary problems and setbacks should not shake our determination to achieve that goal. There is room in both China and the West to adjust and reduce the suspicions of each other. And then bold, reform and opening up requires us to free our minds. We believe China can be more farsighted and open-minded, and its future will move promising. It seems, Jack Rasmus, that at least in the Global Times editorial, and also I think this is reflected in the People's Daily, there's not a lot of sort of smoke being produced about the arrest of the CFO of Huawei.
It's as though they're playing it down, actually.
They're playing it down, and they're kind of almost blaming the Chinese government should it retaliate, saying, look, let's be open-minded. I think it's very soft, and I think there seems to be a decision taken in China. Maybe I'm wrong about this because it's early. A decision taken in China not to go tit-for-tat with the United States, and if anything, to make more concessions to the United States. What's your take?
Well, my reading of this is that they're saying, let's not fall into the U.S. hardline trap, because if they retaliated tougher, that would play into the Lighthizer-Bolton's whole strategy of blowing this thing up, you see? So, and it would counter the best leverage that China has, and that is to attempt to cut a deal with the Mnuchin and the agribusiness faction in the U.S. trade team. If you came out hard, you would play into the hands of the Bolton Lighthizer faction and undermine that relationship that had been developed with Mnuchin and the others. And China's playing a long time game here. In other words, the U.S. economy will likely slow significantly starting in 2019, particularly in the winter. And they're probably hoping that economic conditions will force Trump to shift his leverage or his relationship backing the hardliners to the Mnuchin and the ag business. There's a lot of pressures going on in the farm sector in the United States. This thing's beginning to bite. And China has already proposed to buy $100 billion more of agricultural goods and increase the access to its market. So that's what Mnuchin and the ag sector wants in the U.S. And it makes sense for China not to come out tit for tat here over this Huawei thing. And, to keep that relationship with the other two factions that it hopes long term will prevail in the U.S. negotiations with it.
I think my own opinion, and again, this is simply an opinion, is that it's not simply the hardline faction inside the Trump administration. That you're right. There are two or three factions, and Mnuchin represents the faction that does want to have more trade with China and more interaction with China. I agree with that. But it seems to me because the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the military industrial complex have become so hardened against China that even should Trump leave or John Bolton leave or Navarro leave, this thing is going to get bigger. And you see all this coordinated united front with UK, Australia, New Zealand. Dave Leonard has an article. It's the op-ed in the New York Times. It says, first, China, tensions keep rising between the U.S. and China, which isn't an altogether bad thing. This is the New York Times. For too long, American leaders have failed to respond adequately to China's increasing assertiveness, its theft of intellectual property, hostility to foreign companies, aggression in China, and imperial ambitions around the world. A more hawkish policy towards China makes sense. I mean, that's the New York Times. That's not the hardline faction of the Trump administration. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to understand that this trade war, quote, trade war, that just probably erupting here in 19, is really an element of a shift towards a new Cold War with China. You see, technology, this technology issue is a military issue. These new generation technologies will allow China by 2030 potentially to leapfrog the United States militarily. At least some are arguing that. And that's why the U.S. is so intent on stopping this or slowing this to maintain its technology dominance in the world. So, you know, yes, behind this thing, the trade thing is the appearance, the tip of the spear of this shift towards China in political, militarily sense, dimensions here to contain China. Yes.
Jack, we've got 30 seconds left. I just want to ask you a quick question. Do you think that this thing is going to end in a prosecution, or is this just strategizing on the part of the Trump administration in order to get concessions from the Chinese? Are we going to watch this thing go to trial?
And before you answer, to me, this is hostage taking.
I agree with you.
That's hostage taking. Go ahead, Jack. 30 seconds left.
Yeah, no, I don't believe this thing is. This is tactics. This is the U.S. hardliners' tactics. They had this in their breast pocket here when they went. I don't know why they didn't pull the plug at the meeting with Xi. But this is a tactical move. You know, it's not dissimilar to previous tactical moves with ZTE Corp and Broadcom Corporation. That's been going on for months now. We're going to see a lot more of this company-to-company moves by the U.S. to prevent Chinese companies from doing businesses, not just in the U.S., but the U.S. is putting this pressure on allies, on the U.K., Canada, Europe, and so forth to follow suit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Ecuadorian president, Lenin Moreno, has ramped up pressure on WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange to leave his country's embassy in London. Moreno said yesterday that the UK government has agreed to not extradite Julian to any country where he might face the death penalty. But that's a red herring. Assange already has been indicted in the United States, likely for national security crimes, which do not call for the death penalty. We're joined from Moscow by Susie Dawson. She's an activist and the president of the Internet Party of New Zealand. Susie, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Susie, this is a very fluid situation, and I know that you're in touch with people around Julian. Tell us what the latest information is. How serious is this?
I think it's absolutely serious and obviously a critical time. There's been a number of rumors swirling for some time now that Ecuador, the UK and the US want Julian out of the embassy before Christmas. We're certainly doing everything we can to try to prevent that from happening because we believe that Julian's human rights are at serious risk should he leave the embassy or be extradited to the United States.
We have a situation, John, where the United States really, and the reach of the United States judicial repressive system is such that it, you know, it's the 700-pound gorilla. And all the other countries regionally in the Americas and even in Europe, where there are major advanced industrial countries with their own sovereignty, they're not colonies, they keep bowing to U.S. pressure. And Julian Assange, again, we need to say this over and over again because the people are, again, hearing through mainstream media sources, Julian Assange is being demonized.
Yeah.
When he is a media outlet.
He's a journalist.
And there's nothing that WikiLeaks has published which is not true.
See, this is one of the many issues.
Everything WikiLeaks has said has been true. WikiLeaks exposed war crimes. In the United States, it's a crime to classify a war crime. This is also a problem with the Espionage Act in that the prosecution does not have to prove a threat or damage to the national security. They can just say, well, either you released the information or you didn't. But the reason Julian is different is that, number one, he's a journalist. There's a First Amendment defense here. And number two, he did not release this information privately to any hostile government. He doesn't meet the definition of espionage. This is a political witch hunt against him. I wrote recently about this for Reader Supported News, and I said that I feared the only strategy that might be available to Julian is one of jury nullification, because it seems like the Justice Department is adamant that they want to grab him and bring him back here to put him on trial in the Eastern District of Virginia. And there's got to be one juror out there who recognizes that the man is a journalist, that WikiLeaks is a journalistic outlet, and he did not commit a national security crime.
Susie, the problem too, though, what John is saying is correct. But the fact of the matter is, if the U.S. gets its hands on Julian Assange, no matter even if he wins a jury, they're not going to let up.
No.
They're not going to stop. In other words, we're kind of in the fight for Julian Assange's life right now.
I completely agree. I think we need to back it up a little bit. It's really easy to get caught up into the what if of a potential prosecution in the US, but as things stand at the moment, he is still in the Ecuadorian embassy, and we would like to keep him there at least until we can get safe passage for him to a third country. This represents not just, you know, the situation represents not just a massive threat to press freedom, which it is, and to investigative journalism, and a threat to human rights. But it also is a threat to the entire international order in terms of international law, because Ecuador, if they are cooperating with UK and the US as appears to be, if they are in fact selling him in exchange for debt relief, as it appears to be, they are violating a whole host of international laws and, in fact, their own constitution. So we've seen two UN rulings in favour of Julian and of WikiLeaks. It's been confirmed that he is being held in arbitrary detention, that the UK is at fault, and that the UK is supposed to not only allow him safe passage, but actually compensate him for what he has been through. The UK is completely thumbing their nose at that. We've seen the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, which in a decision that's legally binding upon Ecuador, also find in Julian's favour and WikiLeaks' favour and say that, yet again, reiterate that he should be granted safe passage and allowed to realise his asylum. Additionally, Julian is actually protected under the 1953 Refugee Convention, which doesn't say anything about the death penalty, which seems to be the card that's on the table this week, the smokescreen to try to make it okay. Ecuador and Moreno said yesterday that because they've received written assurances that the death penalty won't be applied, that therefore it's okay for Julian to leave. Well, that's not the case at all under the Refugee Convention, which protects his life, his liberty, and his personal integrity, which has been repeatedly violated over the last 8 years that he's been inside the embassy. So I think the fight here is to get these powers, these countries, to respect international law, because the law is on the side of Julian and on the side of WikiLeaks.
Susie Dawson is our guest. Susie, don't know if I'm correct, but correct me if I'm wrong. When the UN determines that someone is the victim of arbitrary detention, when the UN itself says that, in the past, that's led to remedies, that's led to relief, that's led to a change in the status of that person. In other words, their freedom. I believe this is the only time when the UN has declared someone to be the victim of arbitrary detention where the member states haven't gone along with the UN's determination. Am I right about that?
It's not that they haven't gone along with the determination, but the member states in aggregate, but particularly the UK has refused to abide by the decision. And that's where you have to wonder, you know, when it's been other countries, I think there was, you know, 7 or 8 other cases that we'd looked into in various, what we'd consider maybe second or third world countries around the world, where great international pressure had been brought to bear upon those states, even under threats of sanctions or other remedy, to force them to abide by the decision. And yet what we see is when the superpowers are involved, that all of a sudden, you know, they quite happily thumb their nose at the UN and nobody seems to feel that they can do anything about it. And I think what we've seen in France this week is a classic example of where civic remedy is no longer available. People take it into their own hands to enforce what is just and what is ethical and what is moral and what is right. And I think we're at that is a very similar point in the West now, where if international law is made toilet paper of by these governments, our government, then what is left for us to do? At the end of the day, we have to get together ourselves and organize and take to the streets and demand justice. And we've seen in France how quickly the government capitulates when it is confronted with the power of the mass of the civic class.
Very, very true.
Susie, one of the questions that I get all the time is, what can a person, the average person, do to help Julian?
Anything that they do to raise awareness is extremely helpful. So, I mean, we've had people who've printed out bookmarks with Free Assange and #UNIFORJ written on them, gone to their public library and put these bookmarks in, you know, thousands of books in the library. We've had people who've printed out banners and gone and stood on top of a motorway overpass and hung a simple banner that said Free Assange, #UNIFORJ, and that's exposed that message to hundreds of thousands of people, you know, and just people taking initiative in whatever way they can. Like one person walking through New York City with one block of chalk, putting the hashtag #UNIFORJ on all the major boulevards in New York City. That's a classic example of how you can reach the same types of numbers of people that the mass media do. You know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people can be exposed to these messages just by regular citizens taking that initiative to just do that small act, a non-violent act, a legal act, but an act of protest in support of Julian.
Susie is right. Every one of us can do something. Don't wait. If you're in a neighborhood, if you're in a school, if you're in a church, a mosque, a synagogue, if you just are with your family, do something right now. Because as she pointed out, what people do makes a difference. We saw the great power of the French government, seemingly invincible 2 weeks ago, completely changed once people entered the battle. In other words, once they came into political activity, once they engaged, there is no power greater than the power of the people, but it must be mobilized. It must be active. And guess what, everyone? Don't wait for somebody else to activate you. You can do it yourself. Julian Assange has been under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice since 2010 because WikiLeaks released documents that showed that the U.S. government and the military, the government that speaks in our name, was committing war crimes in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The war criminals are not on trial. They're not about to go to jail. They're not facing these serious charges. It's the people, and Julian Assange in particular, who told us about the crimes, who's now facing this kind of repression. So we must do something. Susie Dawson, 1 minute left. If people want to learn more about the case, if they feel they need more information so that as they take action, as they do something, they feel like they're well-informed, where can they go?
Well, look, we have an event tonight, which is an online vigil, which will be live streaming from Unity4J, that's number4j.com, where we will have amazing whistleblowers, journalists, academics who are very, very well learned on this topic and will be speaking and advocating in support of Julian. That's tonight. It's being co-hosted by Joe Lauria, who's the editor-in-chief of the extremely well-respected Consortium News. So I would say go to unity4j.com. That's from 8 p.m. until 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Friday night, today. But also just on the social media, the best place to check in is all the UNIFORJ accounts, Facebook, Twitter, it's all there, @UNIFORJ, #UNIFORJ. We've got 6 months worth of events that you can go back through and learn as much as you want. In terms of official WikiLeaks accounts, visit justiceforassange.com. That's #4 for all of the details about his legal situation. And iamwikileaks.org, that's one word, iamwikileaks.org, is their campaign for Julian.
Okay, that was the voice of Susie Dawson, who joined us from Moscow. She's an activist and the president of the Internet Party of New Zealand. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Today is the 77th anniversary of the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. President Franklin D. Roosevelt called December 7th a day which will live in infamy. The next day, U.S. Congress declared war on Japan. But was the bombing of Pearl Harbor an intelligence failure, or was it a pretext for the U.S. to enter the war? We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Peter Kuznick. Peter is a professor of history and director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He is the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book in the hit Showtime television series, The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Brian.
Peter, your show, your book with Oliver Stone is The Untold History of the United States. Pearl Harbor has been told and told and told over and over again. Is there an untold part of that story?
Well, there are certainly unlearned parts of that story. What most people think of as the untold part is the idea that the United States knew the attack was coming and deliberately made ourselves vulnerable to that attack. And the truth to that, although there is a lot to suggest that that version of the story might be true, Oliver and I, in our studies, decided that that was not the case, that the United States did know that attack was coming. The United States had broken the Japanese diplomatic codes in August 1940, and everything was making clear that an attack was coming, but we didn't expect the attack to happen at Pearl Harbor. The attack was anticipated to come either at the oil-rich Dutch East Indies, or was later Indonesia, or the British colony in Malaya. So far as the U.S. colonies, we thought the most likely target would be the Philippines. And we were preparing for that attack. Cordell Hull, Secretary of State, had broken off talks with the Japanese on November 26th because they had reached an impasse. And the day before that, Secretary of War Henry Stimson had written in his diary, he said, at that day's meeting, Roosevelt brought up the event that we were likely to be attacked perhaps next Monday. Then on November 27th, the War Department alerted General Douglas MacArthur, who was in the Philippines, that hostile action is possible at any moment. They even warned the officers at Pearl Harbor to be ready for an attack, and they had practiced at Pearl Harbor ways to repel such an attack. When the attack came, however, they were caught sleeping. At subsequent congressional hearings, the lawyer Edward Morgan asked Navy Commander Admiral Husband Kimmel. Kimmel was later convicted of dereliction of duty, and he asked him why they left the fleet at Pearl Harbor when they thought an attack from Japan was coming. And Kimmel says, "All right, Morgan, I'll give you your answer. I never thought those little yellow sons of could pull off such an attack so far from Japan." And a lot of other people also underestimated Japanese capabilities. So yes, they knew an attack was coming. They didn't think it was coming at Pearl Harbor. They stupidly left the fleet there, and much of the fleet was damaged. Some of it was destroyed. And that was a Japanese strategy to deal this blow to knock out the U.S. fleet. Now, why did they want to go after Pearl Harbor? Because the fleet at Pearl Harbor could potentially interfere with their going against or trying to seize the Dutch East Indies and seize that oil, which was so essential for continuing their war in China and their other imperial expansion efforts.
Oil was big for the Japanese. The U.S. had imposed a boycott. Was that designed basically to have a war commence?
No, not really. Japan had invaded Manchuria in 1931, but the all-out war against China begins in 1937. And so Japan needs that oil. But in response to that, Japan kept on cutting parts of China off to Western access and Western trade and Western investment and Western markets. And we didn't like that, right? You have to remember that this was a time when there was a lot of colonialism. The British and the French were pursuing their colonies. The Japanese were somewhat latecomers, and so they wanted to create their co-prosperity sphere. And in July of 1941, they invaded Indochina and took Indochina from the French. But in China itself, they were increasingly restricting Western access to what the West wanted. And it was for that reason, you know, the U.S. had had an open-door policy with China that goes back to the 19th century. before the Boxer Rebellion. And it was not just the U.S. All the other Western powers and Japan were also involved in China. So everybody had this fantasy about the China market as being the savior of world economy. Everybody salivated over this potential China market, as we do now, of course. But at that point, when the Japanese started to restrict access to the China market, that's when the United States began to put the pressure, and we began sanctioning oil, and we sanctioned other raw materials and things that the Japanese desperately needed. But they did not necessarily want to go to war with the United States, but they thought that they needed the access to the Dutch East Indies, and the U.S. potentially stood in the way of that. So their goal was to knock out the American fleet with one devastating blow, and it didn't work. They weakened the American fleet, but they didn't knock it out. But there's another part to that story in terms of the untold history that people don't know. And that Japan also, on that day, attacked U.S. bases in the Philippines, in Guam, and Wake Island, and Midway Island. This was a frontal assault. The Japanese attacked Hong Kong, Malaya, the Philippines, Guam, Wake Island, Midway Island. They also invaded Thailand. They also attacked Singapore. In fact, the attack on Malaya actually took place an hour before Pearl Harbor. So this was not just something directed at the United States and Pearl Harbor. This was a much more frontal declaration of war than people realized at the time, or certainly than they remember now.
The next day, Franklin Delano Roosevelt went before the U.S. Congress. The Congress declared war against Japan. Peter Kuznick, this was the last time that Congress actually issued a declaration of war. I mean, we've had many, many wars since then. The Vietnam War, the Korean War, we're still fighting in Afghanistan, we, the U.S. government, meaning. Again, what changed? I mean, why did the Congress abandon its constitutional prerogative and mandate for declarations of war?
Well, that's a serious question and an ongoing debate. And hopefully Congress is going to reassert itself in that regard. And a lot of this has to do with the development of nuclear weapons, because the idea is, and this became debated in the 1950s when we relied on massive retaliation and the New Look defense policy under Eisenhower. And then the question is, how does a president go to Congress to get authorization to launch a nuclear attack? The idea was that this had to be something much quicker. In the Korean instance, that was a UN action because the Soviet Union was boycotting the United Nations at that time over the admission of China. The Chinese Revolution had occurred the previous year in 1949. And so when the U.S. took that measure to the United Nations, they were able to get United Nations support because Russia wasn't there to veto it. But since that point, we haven't declared wars, and much, much too much power has gone to the presidency, to the executive branch, and Congress has shirked its responsibility. So this is a serious problem.
Peter Kuznick is our guest. Peter is a professor of history and the director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book and the hit Showtime television series, The Untold History of the United States. It was a global war, Peter Kuznick, about 20 years after an earlier global war, the war we call World War I. Was the war between the United States and Japan inevitable, regardless of who fired the first shot or where the first shot was fired? In this case, it was Pearl Harbor. Was that war inevitable from your point of view?
It was inevitable once the Japanese invaded China and needed those resources, and once the United States responded by tightening the economic noose around Japan's throat. From that point on, if it hadn't been at Pearl Harbor, it would have been someplace else. If the attack had come in the Philippines, given all the places of conflict, all the places that the Japanese invaded, Roosevelt would have had his justification for declaring war. Roosevelt had wanted to get the United States into war, especially a war in Europe. This has been something that Roosevelt was clear about for a while. The fact that it started in Japan was a surprise to some people, and it didn't necessarily mean that we had to go to war against Germany and Italy. It was 3 days later that Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. Then we declared war on Germany and Italy. But the American public had no appetite for war after the horrific experience in World War I. And World War I was a very demoralizing war.
We're out of time, Peter, but from your point of view, in other words, Pearl Harbor was the thing that congealed public opinion in the United States, overcame that opposition to war. Is that right?
Yes, we were attacked. We considered it a sneak attack because they hadn't declared war. They caught us with our pants down, killed a lot of people, 2,300 troops, 68 civilians. The American people were then finally ready to declare war.
That was the voice of Peter Kuznick. Peter is a professor of history, director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book and the hit Showtime television series, The Untold History of the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
All major tourist sites in Paris will be closed this weekend as authorities expect what they are calling major violence from anti-government demonstrations. The so-called Yellow Vest protests have swelled this week, even after the government postponed the tax increase that set them off. 89,000 police will be deployed around the country, along with armored personnel carriers. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He's the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Welcome, Gilbert. And You've already written about this as well. Tell us what you're hearing from Paris.
Well, this is what's going on. As you indicated in your introduction, the police deployment is going to be unprecedented, 100% deployment. And they also are going to use the military, the Garde Républicaine, to guard a critical center of power, like the Élysée, for example, also Assemblée Nationale, and Place Beauvau and Matignon, which is the Prime Minister and Minister of Interior. So the decision, obviously, from the Macron administration, and Macron has been personally extremely discreet, and that's an understatement. He has not appeared, he has not spoke to any media or make any announcement. He's going to do it supposedly on early next week. I think what he doesn't want to do, he doesn't want to antagonize even more the street. Now, a lot of people are trying to calm down, namely the situation, and call for peaceful protest, namely all the labor union at large, who are calling for negotiation and non-violent demonstration. All the political parties, the Republican, the Rassemblement National, at the exception of one party, which is La France Insoumise of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who has said nothing. Now, the repression is getting worse, and I think we will know more after tomorrow, but I think it's a big strategical mistake from the part of the Macron administration. Yesterday in Marne-la-Vallée, in a high school, 150 high school students were put on their knees and with their hands on top of their head by the cops and were actually arrested because the high school movement is really picking up too. So it's going to be a complete different scenario, and the way they're going to deploy the CRS, the riot police, if you wish, and all the police apparatus, they will not try to block area, but they will be more mobile and seek literally go after what they call noyau dur, or what they call radical gilets jaunes. What I have previously called more like insurgent. Now, something else happened also today. Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said that he will meet a group that call themselves Gilets Jaunes Libres, which are opposed, they're sort of like the soft Gilets Jaunes, as opposed to the radical Gilets Jaunes. What the government is trying to do, and the French media, is drive wedges
oh, yes.
in the movement and attack the people that have been, for not necessarily good reason, have been trying to take advantage for personal gain. Like there's Eric Drouet, there's also Maxime Nicole, a.k.a. Fly Rider. And those two guys have been sort of trying to, if you wish, cash in on the movement to make themselves a name. So Eric Drouet, for example, is going to face judicial action because he called, and he actually backtracked later, he called for people to go to the Élysée Palace, which is, of course, the castle, the center of power, if you wish, where President Macron resides. And then he sort of backtracked, said, no, we don't want to go there to break anything. We just want to talk. Macron doesn't want to talk. Again, this is not going away. And the gas tax is not going to be postponed. It's going to be completely scrapped, at least for the full year. But that's not enough. That is not enough at all. I mean, there's something that came up in the context here that is very important. For example, the French government has decided, and it's really about taxation and trying to reverse the neoliberalist movement of Macron of not taxing his friends, the rich.
We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. He's also written about this. And in a minute, I want to quote your article, Gilbert. But first, Brian, the character, the nature of these demonstrations appear to be changing. We talked to Gilbert several days ago about these demonstrations, and Edouard Philippe, the prime minister, essentially had given up. He conceded to the demonstrators that the gas tax was a bad idea and that it would be suspended for 6 months. Well, all that's happened since then are that the demonstrations have become bigger and more widespread.
Yeah, and I also want to encourage people to read Gilbert Mercier's article. You can find it at newsjunkiepost.com, newsjunkiepost.com. In the article, Gilbert writes, while the movement started as an apolitical protest mainly focused on gas taxes that they deemed unfair, it has, in a matter of 3 weeks, morphed into a movement that calls for many structural changes, as well as the resignation of France's President Emmanuel Macron. Gilbert, it's very typical, in a way, of mass movements that become truly mass movements. In other words, not short-lived but enduring struggles, that the demands change, different sectors enter the protest, the protest divides and cleaves because there's a more moderate wing and a more militant wing. These are all the characteristic features of mass movements and of revolutions. And I want to just ask you, what are the now structural changes? What's the main focus of the movement now that they've won on the issue of gas taxes? Those have been repealed. What are the structural changes that they want?
Okay, well, it's very simple. They want to put back the impôt sur la fortune, which is a giveaway to rich people of 3 billion euro a year, that they suppose they have complete leeway to do whatever they want with that. They're supposed to reinvest that in French companies, which they are not really doing. What they're doing, they're stashing it somewhere, like most rich people, they're hoarders. And they also, and I think there's going to be a move on that, they also want company such as, and it is very important, a tech company, U.S. tech company, which have been getting a huge tax break to set up shop in France, like, of course, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple, to be taxed properly. And the French government has said, the Ministry of Finance said that they will do that, even if those companies move shop elsewhere in Europe. Now, you mentioned very rightly that, you see, those movements, the real one, change agenda and are sort of moving targets. You know, I know you guys are really into history, but you take 1917. Well, really, at the core of it in Russia, at the core of it was the fact that people didn't want to fight in World War One. Okay, so that kind of triggered everything. It kind of snowballed into other things. And this is what the people in power usually live in the bubble. Like Macron, for example, had no experience of executive power whatsoever. He doesn't understand the dynamic of it, and he doesn't understand. He must see that there's people in the heart of France, in like small hub, that have his effigy hanging from a post. I mean, this is some serious stuff. This is no joke. And in my article that you mentioned, I made an analogy with Louis XVI, because to me, it has more to do with the 1789 revolution, the real one, as opposed to the failed one of 1968. And what the Gilets Jaunes also want, which I find very interesting, they want a direct democracy. They feel not represented by the political class, rightly so, okay? And it doesn't matter if they are supposed to be from the right or the left. They feel not represented because to them, and they're right. All those people come from the same school and the same elite. In France, you have, you know, in 1789, for example, you had the aristocracy, the clergy, and the tiers état, which were the common people, okay? Today, France is governed, the aristocracy has been replaced by the people that come from the ENA, École Normale d'Administration, Polytechnique, and Sciences Politiques. They all go through this, basically. Macron is an énarch, Édouard Philippe is an énarch, François Hollande was an énarch, and so on. So there is a class system that is supposed to be based on meritocracy, but is really not based on meritocracy.
That's the voice of Gilbert Mercier. John, we'll see this in action this weekend. Maybe we'll talk about it on Monday. The class system is under threat because of protests. And right now, 89,000 police will be deployed around the country this weekend in France. All the major tourist areas in Paris closed. Obviously, the government is girding for a big showdown. We'll follow it next week.
It'll be a big one. We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again, we take a look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, lefti.blogspot.com. Steve also tweets at Left Eye Blog. Welcome back, Steve.
Hi, everybody.
Good to have you.
We're missing Nicole this week.
We're missing Nicole.
We're going to give it our best shot without her.
Yeah. Although I've gotten emails from the last time Nicole was gone for the day saying that I was too boring to handle this on my own.
Okay. Well, this is a chance for redemption.
I actually did get emails saying I was too boring to handle this.
Redemption. Be funny.
They were from Nicole, right?
Of course they were from Nicole and her mom. Steve Patt, go ahead. Where do you want to start?
Well, the first headline isn't, I actually thought it was funny, but I suppose it's not supposed to be funny. It's from the Washington Post. Russia is trying to undermine Americans' confidence in the justice system, security experts warn. Oh, my God. I say it's too late. The cops and the courts have already done that. The Russians are way too late with their attempt. But this is, of course, a very serious article and just extends the whole Russiagate, you know, Russia's interfering with the elections onto a whole more greater level of paranoia about what Russia is allegedly doing.
Read the first sentence of that article. A group of cybersecurity, national security and legal experts is warning that Russia's efforts to weaken America's democratic institutions aren't limited to elections, but also extend to the U.S. justice system. John, you heard that sentence, right?
I sure did.
Somehow the Russians, oh wait, it's not somehow. There's a very particular way that the Kremlin is messing with Americans' minds by creating a kind of an unhappiness that Americans might have about the U.S. prison system. And you know what the basis of that unhappiness is?
Imagine. Go ahead. Spill those beans.
Having long realized the most effective disinformation is based on a kernel of truth, Moscow latches on to legitimate criticisms of the justice system. Shows like America's Lawyer and the criminal injustice segment of Sputnik's Loud and Clear often weave genuine concerns and viable grievances in with misleading narratives.
I want to punch the Washington Post in the face.
This is the derivative article on which the new Washington Post story is based. Steve Pat, I mean, John and I have been doing criminal injustice segment with Paul Wright and Kevin Gostala, both of whom are experts on the U.S. prison system and what's wrong with it. We've been doing this for a long time. Nobody asked us to do it. We didn't get any orders from the Kremlin. We do it every week. And now this is the basis. This is the basis on which this organization is forming to look into Kremlin interference in the way Americans feel about the U.S. criminal justice system. It's quite something.
I mean, it's a clear case of shooting the messenger. They basically don't like what you're saying because it's true. And to me, it really harkened back to the 2017, January 2017 DNI report, which started the whole Russia interfered with the elections thing, where they highlighted the fact that RT actually covered the Occupy movement and fracking and things like that. And they said things like, RT framed the Occupy movement as a fight against the ruling class and described the current U.S. political system as corrupt and dominated by corporations. And they ran numerous reports on alleged U.S. election fraud, an interesting thing for them to criticize since that's in the news today, and voting machine vulnerability. So basically, it's the fact that RT and Sputnik and you guys, you know, dare to tell the truth about what's happening and a lot of things which are underplayed or are totally not played at all in the mainstream corporate media. And they just don't like that. So it's a classic case of shooting the messenger.
Yeah. The Lawfare blog, which this Washington Post article is then based on, is written by Suzanne Spaulding. She's a former undersecretary at the Department of Homeland Security in the Obama administration, who oversaw cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection. Another person, Harvey Rishikoff, a visiting professor of law at the Temple University Beasley School of Law. They're also part of the think tank Defending Democratic Institutions Project. This, John, this is money raising. These people are trying to get money. They're trying to get government funds so they can expose shows like Loud and Clear, because we run a half hour segment every week on what's wrong with the American prison system.
And without any shame at all, they come out and say that now that this paper is done, this report is done, blaming Loud and Clear for
making Americans think the criminal justice system stinks in America.
They're next going to Congress to brief this before Congress.
Yeah, it's going to be our show.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to point out that their whole argument, one part of their whole argument, makes absolutely no sense. Here, as they do with other issues like Black Lives Matter, they make the following statement. They say they take both sides because the goal is to whip up controversy and discredit institutions. Well, if you wanted to discredit the justice system, why would you post something that supported the justice system? You don't take both sides. You take the side that if you're trying to discredit them, you post things that discredit them. You don't post things that credit them. That just makes no sense at all. The whole basic argument makes no sense, but they count on people not really thinking that deeply about this argument, really.
Steve Pat, let's go on to another headline. Again, there was the old Cold War. Now there's a new Cold War. Let's look at this Washington Post story.
Yeah, now this is something you've talked about a couple times, the INF, and the headline here, again, from the Washington Post, Trump administration gives Russia an ultimatum on Cold War era arms treaty. And it's just implied in the headline, but the whole article is about the supposed Russian violations of the INF, which is why Trump says they're going to withdraw from it and so on. And this is something you talked about yesterday in a different story where you said something didn't come up until the fifth or sixth paragraph. Well, in this article in the Washington Post, it's not until the 27th paragraph that they finally get to the following statement. The Kremlin says it continues to adhere to the treaty. And nowhere, by the way, in the entire article is there any evidence that they actually are violating the treaty. The reason I want to make this point about the 27th paragraph is because I read this article first in my local paper, the San Jose Mercury News. And the San Jose Mercury News, like I suspect a lot of local papers around the country, only ran the first 11 paragraphs of the Washington Post article, which means readers of the San Jose Mercury News, like myself, who didn't seek to, who didn't go online to the Washington Post to look for the original article, never read the Kremlin denials or the Kremlin statement that they're adhering to the treaty. They only read this whole article about how Russia's violating this treaty. So the placement of things in articles, besides for the headlines, becomes very, very important.
I'm glad Steve mentioned this because he's right. A lot of papers will do derivative articles from the Washington Post or the New York Times. They don't have the same coverage. So, yeah.
And they'll edit them.
If you're going to get the Russian denial in the 27th paragraph, there's a very strong chance that the readers of the original article aren't going to read it because nobody reads 27 paragraphs. But they can't possibly read it if it's only, you know, shortened to 11 paragraphs. Let's keep going, Steve. What's next?
Right. Well, I'm afraid we're still stuck on Russia in the next headline, which Mattis says Putin tried to, quote, muck around. I love the phrase, muck around in November's midterm elections.
How did that mucking take place?
Well, that's the interesting thing. This is an article from CBS News, and there isn't a single word in this article, a single piece of indirect evidence or direct evidence, any evidence at all to back up that statement. But what's interesting about that is the article also quotes Mattis as saying he hasn't seen a smoking gun implicating MBS in the Khashoggi murder.
Because it was a chainsaw. It wasn't a gun.
It was a smoking chainsaw. So they're willing to, they note that he requires smoking gun evidence, but when he tells them that Putin, quote, personally, undoubtedly, tried to muck around the elections, they're willing to put that in the headline with no evidence whatsoever. I mean, it just shows the kind of bias that they run with on these stories.
I see there's another story about Libya, another headline, inside the chaos and corruption of Tripoli, where militias rule the streets. Why is that there?
Well, this is another classic sin of omission, what I call sin of omission. In the entire article, there's only one reference to what led to this situation, and I'm going to read it verbatim. Muammar Gaddafi was deposed and killed in the Arab Spring Revolution. So you have no idea from either the headline or from a fairly long article that the U.S. and NATO had anything to do with this situation whatsoever. It just happened.
John Kiriakou, it was U.S. NATO bombers that destroyed the car caravan that Gaddafi was in.
Yeah, we were leading from behind, though.
You were leading from behind. We blew up the car caravan. Gaddafi tried to escape the lynch mob. They chased him into a sewer pipe, and there they executed him in the most brutal possible way. But it's not called a U.S. NATO bombing or regime change or lynching. It was killed in the Arab Spring Revolution. Some revolution.
You know, the crazy thing is, too, having been at the CIA working on terrorism issues for such a long time, everybody knew that Gaddafi was a friend of ours on terrorism issues. If you wanted to keep Libya and North Africa safe, you improve relations with Muammar Gaddafi. You don't help to overthrow him. Now it's chaos over there, and everybody's pointing the finger at somebody else.
And the return of slavery.
Actual, literal slavery.
And you had, on the other hand, Muammar Gaddafi. Of course, Libya has a great deal of oil wealth. It's got the largest oil reserves of any country in Africa.
And the cleanest oil.
And as a consequence, Muammar Gaddafi was funding the Organization of African Unity. It was funded by Libya. Now, instead, we have African slavery in Libya. And again, the sin of omission, as Steve Pat put it, because it was the U.S., it was NATO, it was France and British colonialism, the former colonial powers coming back to Africa.
And Hillary Clinton bragged about it.
We came, we saw, he died, she said laughingly on the day that Muammar Gaddafi, 70-year-old head of state, was literally lynched in the streets.
Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Pat. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. Steve also tweets at Left Eye Blog. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking that page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make
make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.